طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We spend a good deal of time on this program doing reports about the security mechanisms employed by Israel to control the lives of Palestinians under occupation. At the center of these control mechanisms is Israel's use of the Palestinian Authority, which, rather than being a trusted Palestinian institution that has as its mission the security and well-being of the Palestinian people, as was its hope when it was established by the Oslo Accords, has become a security tool of the Israeli military. It is therefore deeply distrusted and even despised by a majority of the Palestinian public. We begin with an illustration as to why that has become the reality for the Palestinian Authority, the PA. Here is a Mondo Weiss story about how the PA stifles critical Palestinian speech. When the plain-clothed men came for him, Kifa Kuzmar, 27, did not need to be told why they were dragging him out of the popular Ramallah cafe on a sunny afternoon last week. "Call my brother," he told bystanders before being tossed into the back of a tinted SUV with a yellow Israeli license plate parked outside. Despite the tags on their vehicle, the officers making the arrest were not Israeli police. They were the Palestinian Secret Service and had come to take Kifa for insulting them. "The Muhabarat are rotten," Kuzmar wrote on a Facebook 2 weeks before he was detained, using the Arabic colloquial term for undercover Palestinian intelligence agents. In the West Bank, such words are a punishable offense under a 1960 Jordanian law still on the books, making illegal insulting a public official. The crime carries a maximum of a 6-month prison sentence. Indeed, the undercover agents were insulted. Kuzmar was driven to a holding cell. During the ride, officers beat him. "I said, hit me, but don't break the sunglasses because they are not mine," he recounted with a smile. The police obliged. The shades were set aside. During his week in jail, Kuzmar missed 2 exams for his university courses in business. He spoke to Mondo Weiss within an hour of his release after his brother posted a bond of $7,000 paid in Jordanian dinar, as customary with the Palestinian court fees, reflecting the myriad of Ottoman, Jordanian, and Palestinian laws governing West Bank residents. The director of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, Amar Dwak, told Mondo Weiss Kuzmar's arrest reveals the underreported limitations of free speech in the West Bank. "Security forces in the West Bank and Gaza, they are using the penal code, a criminal law that is outdated," Dwak said. Under the provision of insulting a public official last year, Palestinian police arrested 30 and in the year before, 48, all for posts made on social media. A further 18 journalists were detained on free speech-related issues, all prosecuted under the insult law. The process varies for how police apprehend public insulters. At times, intelligence officials haul Palestinians into custody, as in Kuzmar's case. In these instances, they were arrested or sometimes summoned by security forces. Some were jailed for several days, Dwok said. Dwok underscored these types of detention that violate Palestinian basic law as of 2014, when Palestine signed onto a series of international conventions on human rights. The accords were ratified at the same time when the Palestinian Authority joined the International Criminal Court. It was a moment of state-building obligations the government gave itself. But in the years since, little has been done to implement these new protections for free speech. There are trends on who is targeted. Most are in their 20s or 30s. If you say the security agencies collaborate with Israel, if you insult the president or the prime minister, Palestinians could face arrest. Kuzmar believes he was arrested not for the Facebook post itself, but for his involvement in campus politics. He acted in two short plays a few weeks before in the run-up to the student elections hosted by the left-leaning bloc. In the West Bank, student factions are arms of the official political parties, and his short acting career gave him prominence among his student peers. I know every day as a Palestinian I feel I am being watched by the Israelis or the Palestinians, said Kuzmar, relating when in jail intelligence agents attempted to hack into his social media accounts. Although prospects are high for Kuzmar to have charges against him dropped when he appears in court, Palestinian human rights groups are concerned about the trend of arrests for seemingly benign, although certainly rude, social media writings. The legal rights group Adamir told Mondeweiss it condemns arrests related to expression of political opinions through Facebook posts and calls the Palestinian government to respect the Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The group went on to quote from the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which Palestine has signed on to, stating, "Everyone shall have the right to freedom of expression. The right shall include freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing, or in print, in the form of art, or through any other media of his choice." Our feature presentation this morning is a speech activist Nancy Murray gave on her recent return from her 13th trip to Gaza. It is difficult to fathom life in Gaza, which has suffered prolonged attacks by Israel and is completely shut off from the outside world. We cannot forget Gaza or stop telling its story, which is why we want you to hear Nancy's update on conditions there. Here is Nancy Murray, introduced by Tufts University professor Amal Bishara.
So Nancy Murray has been an activist for peace with justice in the Middle East since 1988, when she paid her first visit to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. She subsequently founded the Middle East Justice Network and the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. She's written a book and many articles on Israel-Palestine, and she serves on the editorial committee of the British journal Race and Class. She holds a PhD in history from Oxford University. She's taught at universities and worked for human rights in the United Kingdom and Kenya, as well as the United States. For 25 years, she also served as the director of education at the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. And as I think all of us know, she's a tremendous gift and asset to our community here in so many different ways.
Thank you so much, Amal. Thank you all for being here and for that very warm welcome. Now, on April 18th, I paid my 13th visit to the Gaza Strip. The process of getting into Gaza last month bore little resemblance to my first trip early in 1988, shortly after the launch of the vibrant uprising of the entire civil population known as the Intifada. Since then, it's now called the First Intifada. That was launched in Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp. Then it was possible to take a spur-of-the-moment decision to drive from East Jerusalem to Gaza City. Now, there was a several-month application process for an Israeli entry permit in order to participate in a mental health and human rights conference organized by the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. At pretty much the last moment, the dozen or so internationals planning to attend the conference were informed that permits for our entry had been obtained by a German NGO that was co-sponsoring the conference. I should say on several occasions I have had permits turned down. At the Erez crossing, it took a few hours to pass through the three separate stations where documents and luggage were scrutinized. First, in a huge, dehumanizing Israeli transit terminal where waiting can be interminable, especially for Palestinians. Then, about a kilometer down a very ominous-looking concrete funnel, we went to a more modest station manned by the Palestinian Authority. And finally, a short taxi ride away in the now permanent-looking Gaza border control terminal. We had our papers scrutinized by Hamas officials, and I must say this entry point bore no resemblance to the battered storage container in which I had been processed by Hamas officials during a 2009 visit. Only then can one properly say one is inside the spit of land just 26 miles long and a handful of miles wide that is wedged between the Mediterranean Sea, Israel, and Egypt. Down here, that is the Gaza Strip. I'm sure you all know where it is. The Gaza Strip has had a rich history from at least the 18th century BC. Think of that. Formerly a district in Mandatory Palestine, the Gaza Strip, as it became known after the creation of the State of Israel, is now home to 1.8 million people, nearly half of them children under 15 years of age. 1.2 million are refugees, a large proportion of whom are caged just miles from their former homes. Many can look over to where they used to live, inside what is now Israel. Since we are here at the Friends Meeting House, I should mention that it was the American Friends Service Committee that, before the formation of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, first looked after the 200,000 refugees who had fled or were pushed out of what became Israel into what they hoped would be the protection of the Egyptian army, causing the population of the area to triple in just 1 year. Now all the people in the Gaza Strip live in what is essentially an open-air prison under the incessant gaze of Israeli drones, surveillance balloons, the remote killing spot and shoot system housed in watchtowers built into prison walls, and sentry guns that fire automatically from pillboxes when alerted by sensors. Frequent targets of these weapons are farmers who venture onto what used to be their rich agricultural land, but is now deemed by Israel to be part of an elastic, 1 mile wide no-go zone that consumes nearly a fifth of the Gaza Strip. Tanks and naval ships patrol the perimeters, and F-16s and Apache helicopters can unload their lethal cargo at any time, as they did last week in southern Gaza. For a decade, the Gaza Strip has been under near total lockdown, as an Israeli siege on the territory has blocked movement in and out of people and goods. And I should say that thousands, it's up to 30,000 Gazans, need medical treatment outside the Gaza Strip. Many have been having cancer treatment and have been blocked from getting it. Many thousands of students are kept from accessing their universities abroad or in the West Bank. So these are the people the closure is immediately affecting. Tonight, I want to do three things. First, briefly summarize the evolution of the siege conditions and the accumulated trauma that Gaza has endured since the first Intifada. Second, give you some impressions from my April visit. And finally, say something about how we here in the United States can channel the outrage I hope you will be feeling by the time I conclude my remarks. So first, for some recent history. When I first visited the Gaza Strip in 1988, hospital beds were full of young men and children who had endured the force, might, and beatings, that was the term used, that then Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin had ordered to put down an unarmed uprising of the entire population. Many had been shot at close range, and all night long I would hear screams and gunshots and the wailing of ambulances. 1,200 Palestinians were killed during the first uprising, even though their only weapons were stones. The Gaza economy suffered greatly during the first Intifada and as a result of the first Gulf War. By 1992, it was so bad that when the UN advertised 8 jobs for garbage collectors, it got 11,655 applications. But it was under the so-called Oslo peace process of the mid and late 1990s that Gaza's economy was throttled, as Sarah Roy, a local one, I'm sure many of you know her, she lives in Boston, and she has written the best books about the de-development of the Gaza Strip. Gazans were cut off from jobs in Israel and increasingly from the West Bank, where Oslo ushered in the doubling of the number of Israeli settlers. After a settler from Brooklyn, Baruch Goldstein, murdered 29 Palestinians at prayer in Hebron's Ibrahim Mosque, you'll hear more about that in a minute, Hamas carried out its first suicide bombing. The year was 1994. Hamas was put on the U.S. government's list of terrorist organizations the following year. And this is the basis for the U.S. no-contact rule, which operates today. Basically, there can be no contact at all with anybody in the Gaza government because they are presumably in some way connected to Hamas, or in case they are connected to Hamas. Now, as you may recall, the failure of the Oslo process and the provocative September 2000 appearance by then Likud head Ariel Sharon, surrounded by 1,000 Israeli police when he approached the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is what sparked a second Palestinian uprising in which armed groups and suicide bombers eventually participated, not in the beginning, but eventually. And from 2000 to 2008, Israel repeatedly used tanks, F-16s, and helicopter gunships against a defenseless civilian population. Some 3,000 people were killed in the Gaza Strip alone during these years. This is the per capita equivalent of 600,000 American dead. Among them were approximately 700 children. Now, I would like to tell you about one event I personally witnessed, one incident. I witnessed at least its aftermath. In July 2002, after the Israeli military had reinvaded the West Bank and Gaza Strip, destroying thousands of Palestinian homes, extinguishing hundreds of lives, the Palestinian Authority and Hamas reached an understanding that suicide bombings within Israel had to stop. Just 90 minutes before an announcement to that effect was to be made on July 22, 2002, The Israeli Air Force dropped a one-ton bomb on an apartment building in a densely crowded neighborhood of Gaza City, reportedly in an effort to kill a Hamas leader. 16 Palestinian civilians, including 11 children, perished. And when I went to the site of the bombing the following day, I found people in shock and children's shoes and school supplies scattered through the rubble. The suicide bombings continued. Israel's withdrawal of its settlers from the Gaza Strip in 2005 completed the transformation of the Strip into what the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem referred to as the largest prison on earth. Totally encircled by walls, fences, and towers, Israel continued to control its air, sea, and land, and who goes in and out. And once settlers were gone, Palestinians were repeatedly subjected to eardrum-shattering sonic booms and frequent tank fire and missile strikes. The IDF could attack the Gaza Strip with increasing impunity, as it did in various operations, one in June 2006, which destroyed the only power plant in the Gaza Strip, and then again it attacked in November 2006. In the words of the Israeli academic Avi Shlaim, quote, "The figures speak for themselves. In the 3 years after the withdrawal from Gaza, 11 Israelis were killed by rocket fire. On the other hand, in 2005-07 alone, the IDF killed 1,290 Palestinians in Gaza, including 222 children," end quote. The closure was tightened after Hamas won the January 2006 legislative election that former U.S. President Jimmy Carter called democratic and fair. It was transformed into a chokehold in June 2007 after a clash with a CIA-backed Fatah militia led to a total Hamas takeover of the territory. And under the harsh economic siege then initiated by Israel, only 12 basic items were permitted to enter the Gaza Strip, and just enough of them to keep people alive. Electricity and food were severely rationed. Cement, soap, many medical supplies, potable water, and raw materials were kept out altogether as Israel made Hamas-ruled Gaza a laboratory for trying out new weapon systems and finding the breaking point of human beings. On March 6, 2008, a coalition of human rights groups issued a devastating report entitled "The Gaza Strip, a Humanitarian Implosion." It concludes, quote, "This humanitarian crisis is a direct result of ongoing collective punishment of ordinary men, women, and children, and is illegal under international law. Peace will not be achieved by locking 1.3 million people into a prison of spiraling poverty and misery." End quote. Still, the siege went on, preparing Gazans for the shock and awe of Israel's military might over the next 6 years. In 6 years, there were three major military attacks. I'm sure you remember Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense, and then in the summer of 2014, the 51-day onslaught known as Operation Protective Edge. These offensives killed thousands of people, more than 800 of them children, and wreaked massive destruction on homes, schools, hospitals, municipal buildings, the industrial area, agricultural lands, and the vital infrastructure for water, sewage, and electricity. And after each aggression, the Israeli-imposed closure remained in place, barring the import of essential building materials and forcing people to live in the rubble of their homes. Such had been the methods used by Israel in its seven decades-long project of attempting to destroy resistance to dispossession. It is in the Gaza Strip that Palestinian resistance has, over the years, been at its most unrelenting and determined, and so has Israel's determination to stamp it out. Now bear this background in mind as I turn now to impressions from my recent trip. Remember that half of Gaza Strip's population are children, and that these children have endured a 10-year-long siege and 5 major military attacks during that decade. My first meeting on entry was with an old friend, a Gazan doctor, who informed me that, quote, Gaza is terminally ill, end quote. And much of what I saw and heard over the next 4 days seemed to lend weight to that assertion. Nearly 2 years after the end of the 2014 attacks, which left much of the Gaza Strip in ruins, one bombed-out tower block still dangerously tilts over a Gaza City road. But explosives and ordnance have largely been cleared away, along with the rubble of thousands of hospitals, schools, and mosques. By the way, 73 mosques were totally destroyed and another 200 or so damaged. And what you see in places where the damaged buildings and the destroyed buildings were are now large sandy patches of earth and tangled piles of metal, the remains of vehicles and rebar. Although some new mosques and a new hospital have been built with funds from Qatar and Kuwait, what you do not see much of is reconstruction in neighborhoods blasted by war. Less than half of the $5.4 billion in reconstruction funds pledged in a 2014 conference for rebuilding Gaza, mostly by Gulf countries, less than half of that amount has been delivered. But a bigger problem than the funding shortage, is the UN-brokered Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism, or GRM, which was agreed to by the Palestinian Authority and Israel. It is designed to keep any materials that may have a dual use, say for a house and possibly a tunnel, out of the hands of the Hamas government. GRM gives Israel a case-by-case approval power over all applications for construction material. It requires a cumbersome bureaucratic process for pre-approval and then constant supervision by cameras and special storage facilities and monitoring by drones of how materials are used. Twice last month, Israel barred the import of cement, alleging it was being transferred to people associated with Hamas and could be used to build tunnels. When I encountered some of the areas that had been hardest hit in 2014, I found families living in partially destroyed buildings without 4 walls, which were death traps for children, and which lacked water, electricity, and any form of sanitation. Other houses had been patched up. According to UN figures, 3,000 of the 18,000 homes that were entirely destroyed or severely damaged are now habitable. That's 3,000. But nearly 100,000 of the 500,000 Gazans who were forced to flee during the war are still displaced from what had been their homes. They are renting, some have moved in with relatives, or are living in storage facilities or other makeshift structures. Not only has the pace of reconstruction been dismally slow, but it has provided few jobs for residents struggling with unemployment rate of nearly 50%. Deepening poverty, combined with total lack of freedom of movement, has hit young people especially hard. Among them, tens of thousands of university graduates without any prospects for employment. I was told these conditions have led to an upsurge in anger and despair and rise in suicide rates to a level never before seen in the Gaza Strip. But what makes the Gaza Strip terminally ill, as my doctor friend put it, isn't to do with reconstruction. It's to do with the breakdown of the vital infrastructure that sustains life, namely water, electricity, sewage. In 2012, This infrastructure had already been destroyed by wars. And in 2012, a UN report warned that water and electricity crisis in the Gaza Strip could render it unlivable. That was their word, by 2020. But how livable is it today? When electricity is only on available for 8 hours a day and then sporadically, when 95% of the water supply is contaminated by seawater and sewage, when 80 million liters of raw sewage is dumped into the Mediterranean Sea every day, and when giant lakes of sewage accumulate and sometimes overflow their banks. I visited one of these sewage lakes, sewage basins in the north of the Gaza Strip, and heard from a family in nearby al-Nasr about how they took refuge on the roof of their house when the sewage turned to a flood that killed 5 people and many animals. I find it simply unconscionable that Israel and the United States are prepared to let 1.8 million people live in these conditions and die in these conditions because infant mortality is rising, as is maternal mortality. And why are they doing this? They're doing this because importing the vital materials to fix the infrastructure of the Gaza Strip would require dealing with Hamas officials. This brings me to another factor contributing to the despair felt by Palestinians I talked to in both the Gaza Strip and West Bank, namely the failure of attempts to overcome the calamitous Fatah-Hamas rift. The formation of a functioning unity government with which the United States could deal could provide a lifeline for Gaza and could bring the West Bank and Gaza Strip closer together. But it has not happened. And some speculate that the reasons have less to do with the bad blood between Palestinian factions than with external pressures exerted not just by the U.S. and Israel, but by other players seeking influence in a newly volatile region. In current circumstances of strangling siege and regional upheaval, many fear that Palestinians themselves do not have the agency to move beyond the fragments in order to move forward with the national cause. So that really did strike a lot of people as a cause for great alarm. But alongside this very bleak picture is another reality that I need to convey in the time remaining to me, because it would do great injustice to the spirit of the people of the Gaza Strip to leave you with the impression that they are sunk in depression and at the end of their collective tether. On several occasions during this brief visit, I again experienced the personal warmth, generosity, and exuberance that made the Gaza Strip such an enticing place when I first visited it during the heady days of the First Intifada and during many subsequent trips. An astonishing fortitude was evident during the Gaza Community Mental Health Program's 2-day conference, which was attended by 800 people from around the Gaza Strip. The imperative of addressing the collective injustice inflicted on the Palestinian people has made the GCMHP, that's the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, more than a mental health service provider as typically understood in the West. Instead, it is engaged in human justice work, recognizing that human rights, security, and the quality of life are fundamental to mental health, and that essential mental health needs of Palestinians cannot be fully met without a social, economic, and political transformation. The director of the GCMHP is Dr. Yasser Abu Jameh, who lost 28 members of his extended family in a single missile strike in 2014. He declared in his keynote speech that, quote, planting hope is our main duty, end quote. And I saw the work of instilling hope in the energy with which the GCMHP and other organizations I visited labored to heal the spirit of traumatized children and to bring hope to young people who felt they had no future and to women at the receiving end of a vicious spiral in domestic violence. I saw it in the determination of students, men and women, working together to transcend their confinement by making creative use of the internet and becoming vigorous advocates for an end to human rights abuses, not just in the Gaza Strip, but across the region. And I recommend you have a look at the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, which they are part of. Had I been there longer, I am sure I would have discovered beacons of hope all around the Gaza Strip. For in the context of Gaza, the word resilience has been taken to a whole new level. So what steps can we in this room take to nourish hope among a people who have for far too long experienced the full weight of the more than $100 billion in just military aid that successive U.S. governments have given Israel? Now, I'm going to just mention three concrete things, and I know that we will hear of more ideas from Isa. First, you can support the indispensable mental health work being undertaken in the Gaza Strip by donating to the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, which I co-founded in 2001. Do take one of the brochures in the front of the room to find out more about how the funds we collect are used. And second, you can sign up to get more information about the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, formerly the Boston Alliance for Water Justice. This is a group that is raising consciousness about the many ways Israel is using water as a weapon against the Palestinian people, including in the Gaza Strip. I should say we got started to campaign against the water partnership that Massachusetts had formed with Israel. We succeeded in getting that partnership put on hold, and we are now making sure that it is not revived. Yay. And finally, you can insist that Israel's 10-year-old siege of Gaza and its nearly 50-year-old occupation are brought to an end. You can do this, making sure this language is part of any campaign you are involved in, whether BDS or other campaign. You can bring the message to your friends, your neighbors, your church and community groups, your local newspaper, and most crucially, your elected officials. Batter them with that message. They must hear it. And the time to do this has never been more ripe than now, when there are growing signs within the U.S. of a shift in public attitudes towards Palestine, especially among young people. Palestinians I talked to last month are aware of the shift, and it gives them hope. Bernie Sanders, by the way, has a sizable fan club in the Gaza Strip for one single reason. He recognizes that Palestinians are people too, and actually dared say as much in his debate with Hillary Clinton. Isn't it shameful that no other politician has said this? So changing U.S. policy is obviously a very tall order, but I want to close with words attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. Quote, "Strength does not come from physical capacity," he said. "It comes from an indomitable will," end quote. And I saw in the Gaza Strip an indomitable will that has helped sustain its people through so many difficult years. If we develop the indomitable will to work for freedom, equality, and justice in Palestine and Israel, who knows what we will achieve? Thank you.
That was Nancy Murray reporting on her recent trip to Gaza. With the time left to us, we want to underscore Nancy's sobering report with some recent news out of Gaza. Gaza rescue crews tried to salvage livestock and produce on Wednesday after a sewage reservoir collapsed, flooding about 25 acres of farmland in a new sign of the worsening water and sewage crisis in the Hamas-run territory. Residents said about 10.5 million gallons of raw sewage poured out of the reservoir on Tuesday and flooded the Sheikh Ajlin neighborhood in southern Gaza City in just 15 minutes. "We heard a terrifying sound," said Jamal al-Jedi, a farmer. "Suddenly the water broke into the greenhouse and farm and destroyed everything. I lost everything," he said, wringing his hands as he looked at cucumbers soaked in wastewater. In a nearby chicken farm, people pull eggs out of mud and sewage. Mohammed Kandil, a beekeeper, said the sewage reached the room in which he kept the honey he had just harvested. "I will get rid of it after I wake up from the shock," he said. He managed to rescue several hives, placing them on tires away from the wastewater. But swarms of flies hovered around the damaged white hives. Gaza's limited sewage treatment facilities have been overwhelmed by a rapidly expanding population, damage to infrastructure during the wars with Israel, and a chronic shortage of electricity. The sewage issue is huge in Gaza. It is polluting the land and the water system. And perhaps what might be considered by some poetic justice, it is polluting the Mediterranean Sea, which means the beaches of Israel. Here is that story. Each day, millions of gallons of raw sewage pour into the Gaza Strip's Mediterranean beachfront, spewing out of a metal pipe and turning miles of once scenic coastland into a stagnant dead zone. The sewage has damaged Gaza's limited freshwater supplies, decimated fishing zones, and after years of neglect is now floating northward and affecting Israel as well, where a nearby desalinization plant was forced to shut down, apparently due to pollution. It's certain that Gaza Strip's beaches are completely polluted and unsuitable for swimming and entertainment, especially in the summer, said Ahmed Yaqoubi of the Palestinian Water Authority. Environmentalists and international aid organizations say that if the problem isn't quickly addressed, it could spell even more trouble on both sides of the border. But while Israel has a clear interest in Gazans repairing their water infrastructure, that would likely require it to ease restrictions on the import of building materials, which it fears the territory's Hamas rulers could divert for military purposes, and increase the amount of electricity it sells to Gaza. The delays in sewage treatment are exacerbating a water crisis. Years of overdrawing Gaza's underground aquifer have allowed seawater to infiltrate into its only source of drinking water. Sewage flows into the aquifer as well. We can say that 100% of the water is not potable, said Water Authority's Yaqoubi. More than 150 private water purification businesses have proliferated across Gaza to offer clean drinking water. We want to close this week with an editorial from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. It concerns Gaza and is the kind of critical editorial that you will not see in an American newspaper because of the fear of the blowback by the Israeli lobby. Believe it or not, freedom of the press, or should I say courage of the press, is more prevalent in Israel than it is in the United States. Here is that editorial from the Israeli Haaretz newspaper. May 17, 2016. The enclave of Gaza, one of the most densely populated places in the world, will mark a decade of life under a strangulating siege next month. Some 2 million people, many born since the blockade was in place, are imprisoned there in a frightening human experiment, as if someone were trying to study how long people can survive when they are isolated from the world, their cultural environment, and any economic or national horizon. In order to keep this enclave alive, Israel sends in measured and insufficient quantities of construction materials. It also allows the transfer of food and medicines, and in exceptional cases, even permits a few hundred people to leave, a little less than 1,000 people since January of 2016. The Gaza Strip is caught by the throat in a pincer movement, with one arm being held by Israel and the other by Egypt, which has sealed the Rafah border crossing on all but a few days a year. Recently, Jordan has erected an unofficial barrier against Gaza's residents. Gazans say they have experienced trouble obtaining transit visas to enter the Hashemite Kingdom. Without these permits, Israel won't allow them to leave Gaza, and Jordan won't allow them to enter its territory. So another possible exit route from the Strip has been blocked, and a move that symbolizes the inconceivable hardships imposed on civilians whose only desire is to leave in order to study, obtain medical treatment, or just breathe the air outside of Gaza. There is no justification for the closure of Gaza. It hasn't prevented missiles from being fired at Israel. It hasn't caused the hoped-for public uprising against the Hamas government. And it constitutes an incubator for the development of despair and cycles of violence that have made the lives of residents of southern Israel intolerable. Moreover, the negotiations Israel is conducting with Turkey over a rehabilitation of their bilateral relationship is likely to lead to a significant easing of the siege. This proves that the blockade has lost its security justification and is now serving as a diplomatic bargaining chip, and not even between Israel and the Palestinians, but between Israel and a third party. Residents of Gaza, who thought they were imprisoned in their towns only because of the Hamas government, are now being asked to be patient until Israel and Turkey resolve their differences. The Israeli government must immediately end its blockade of the Gaza Strip, stop playing with the lives of some 2 million people, and offer them some practical means of leaving Gaza so they can exercise what the enlightened world considers basic human rights. This Palestinian ghetto must be opened. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be a Palestinian activist, Issa Amaro, from Hebron, who recently spoke in Cambridge. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.